Get a $20 bonus win or lose this weekend with Naira bets. Here's how. Bet a $50 win bet on the Gotham Stakes at Aqueduct and a $50 win bet on the Tampa Bay Derby at Tampa Bay. Both with the Naira Bets app, regardless if your ticket's hit or not, earn a $20 bonus. New to Naira Bets, sign up today with promo code REWIND200, that's REWIND200, and earn a $200 sign-up bonus. That's a $200 sign-up bonus and a $20 win bet bonus. Start playing today at NairaBets.com or download the Naira Bets app. And also, don't forget, this Friday is the last day to register for the Gotham Challenge online contest. This contest features a $3,000 buy-in, including $2,000 of live bankroll and $1,000 in the prize pool. The Gotham Challenge includes a cash prize pool, two NHC seats, and a $3,000 Naira contest seat. Registration closes on this Friday, March 5th. Visit Naira.com/challenge for more details and register today. Welcome to episode 81 of Red Bull Rewind. My name is Spencer Lugmuir, and today I have a very special guest, that being Acacia Courtney of Gulfstream Park, to go over the crazy 14 race card from this past Saturday. We go over races 8, 9, 10, and 12, and some angles that we found throughout the card were why we may have not seen Greatest Honor's best race yet, how if you tossed some races at a track a horse didn't like, you would have found a Grade 3 winner, and why the horse for course angle still works deep into racing meets. This is Red Board Rewind. It's the same old story in this tugboat. And now I'd like to welcome in my special guest for this week's episode of Red Board Rewind. She is one of the analysts down at Gulfstream Park. She is newly engaged, and she has also started out on her podcasting career in the money as well. It's Acacia Courtney. Acacia, how are you today?
I'm great, Spencer. Thanks very much for the nice intro.
It's just the same thing kind of happened to me last year. I also got engaged, and it's always so funny. It's like, you think you won't feel different. I felt way different the day after. How about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of crazy because, you know, we had talked about, you know, an engagement and wanting to spend the rest of our lives together and all of that stuff, of course. So the fact that we were going to get engaged wasn't a surprise, but I was completely oblivious that it was going to take place last weekend. Like, I thought for sure that I would pick on something either from Miguel or from my mom or my co-host Ron Nicoletti, apparently new for a week. And anybody that knows Ronnie knows that he is incapable of keeping a secret. So I thought for sure I would pick it up from somebody, and I was completely caught off guard. So it was really exciting, and it was wonderful and special. And my parents had quarantined and did, you know, COVID tests to come down and be there and surprise me. So we all got to celebrate afterwards together, which was incredible. And we're just really, really happy for this next chapter.
It's fantastic. Also, another chapter with you is becoming a podcast host. How much of a difference is it compared to just you doing your, you know, stuff for Naira or just the analyst work down there for Gulfstream? I feel like when I'm on Pete's show as a guest, it's definitely a little bit different because you just, as I've said many times, you have so many balls up in the air. You're trying to balance, you know, time. How many questions am I going to ask? Am I going to give them enough time to answer, et cetera?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's definitely a lot different. And also just kind of mapping out the shows each week. The last 2 weeks, I've run into, you know, some roadblocks with coordinating guests or things like that. And I've managed to pull things together. And I think it's worked out great. And I've had people help me out. Whereas like this week, I've been almost overbooked and had to push people to next week, you know? So it's all about kind of managing that as well. I'm a workaholic, which anybody that knows me is well aware of. So if I wasn't busy enough, you know, handicapping the million races a week we have at Gulfstream and all the other production stuff that I do there, it's definitely been another major time commitment, but I've really been enjoying it, and it's been fun being able to kind of find my own voice and see where it takes me kind of thing. And I feel like we're really tapping into some good topics and things that aren't covered much in our industry.
It's one of my favorite podcasts to listen to by the week. A question that kind of popped up into my head, it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I have a notepad that I keep in case I get anything interesting that ever happens in dreams or anything like that. And it was an interesting thought. Obviously, you've done a bunch of pageants in the past. Has and pa pageant prep can be very, very extensive. Do you think that that part of your life really helped you kind of moving over to the horse racing side, where it was kind of like 14 race card this week, it's going to be a ton of time, whereas like the pageant work kind of, it's those full 12-hour days of doing stuff kind of had your mindset much better?
Oh, it's a great question because it's absolutely true. Prepping for pageants and then also years as a ballerina at a very high level. I mean, ever since I was in 8th grade, 7th grade, I had a gym exemption. I would leave school early while I was in high school. I'd commute from Connecticut to New York City to dance and do rehearsal for 4 hours and then come home and do my homework and collapse into bed. So I think I'm pretty proud of my time management skills. And I also have learned to kind of prioritize. And I think that that's been the most important thing. So, unfortunately, some stuff, in my personal life, like going to the dry cleaners or things like that that I need to do, or cleaning my apartment, will at really busy times of the year get pushed to the back burner. But being in a relationship with Miguel, my fiance, who also works in racing, is helpful too because he understands when the big weekends are, that 14 races is a lot of races and that they're important races as well. So there's a great understanding between the two of us. And it's the same thing for me with him, when he has big runners in a graded stakes race coming up or something like that. So we've really done, I think, a great job in kind of finding the balance of things like that. But you're absolutely right. In all of the prep that I've done over years, you have to be able to, A, prioritize what needs to get done soon and what things you can take care of later. And you just don't have time to procrastinate, to be honest.
Another question. One of the races we aren't going to talk about in deep diving is the Fountain of Youth. What were your thoughts on the race overall?
I was standing next to Claudia Spadaro, who does the Spanish broadcast team at Gulfstream, and we were watching on top of the scale house, and I looked at her and I said, I think greatest honor is done, as they were rounding into the far turn. And then all of a sudden, when Jose got him in the clear and he switched leads and he started to gobble up the ground, and I was just saying, wow, over and over again, because I actually thought drain the clock might be home. And that was something I had been worried about. Physically, to my eye, I've never wanted drain the clock to go longer than a mile. I think he's a one turn horse. And after the race, I had heard that Safi said that they will turn back to a one turn distance, as that's just what he's better at. He ran a very valiant race given the fact that he was going 2 turns for the first time. But sometimes at Gulfstream, as it really can be kind to early speed, and especially from an inside post, it can just kind of carry you. I think Promises Fulfilled is a great example of that in years past as well, as he turned out to be a star sprinter. So when they got into the stretch, at first I thought drain the clock was home. And then the distance kind of caught up to him as another horse in Greatest Honor, who wants to go even further, started to really kick in late in closing and finishing with a flourish. The big thing to note with the mile and a 16th at Gulfstream is that it's a first finish line race. So Jose Ortiz didn't have the whole length of the stretch to really get going. And he came back, and the first thing he said to Shug McGahee afterwards was, I'm so glad we don't have to do these first finish lines races anymore with him. He will be so happy to go longer next time. Next time out in the Florida Derby, it'll be a mile and an eighth. And then, of course, on to the mile and a quarter in the Derby. I think he's just going to relish the distance.
I thought this race overall was very interesting. Greatest Honor came back with another 89 buyer, which obviously people after the race, they had originally said it was going to be 83, and then they bumped it back up another 6 points. And just overall throughout the race, Tarantino came back, and I thought we were going to get more of like an Ette Indian type style again, going turf to dirt for the second time. Ran another 80 buyer, drained the clock, only improved 1 point from an 85 to an 86. something overall from just watching all of these preps, obviously Cox's runner came back in the Southwest and won impressively. I'm starting to feel that maybe one of the Fairgrounds runners, for me specifically, Mandaloon, might be very interesting, has been improving every single race. Greatest Honor, obviously, from hearing that interview, is going to possibly excel next time out, but didn't really improve this time out, and I'm wondering if that might be a negative going forward.
Well, to be honest, I haven't had the chance to watch Mandaloon's most recent race in detail, so I'm talking about him a little blind in that I'm just not as familiar with him, whereas Greatest Honor, I've seen the majority of his starts, both in New York and here in Florida as well, even, you know, when he started out in Saratoga. I would have to disagree. I actually do think that he improved. Did I like that he almost seemed to be idling? No, but he is the type of horse. He's so big. I mean, he's like, his whole body is long. His legs are long. Physically, he's long. He just looks like he wants to run a mile and a half. And that's what his pedigree is as well. He's by Tappet, out of the mare that's the sister to Jazzle and Rags to Riches. He is bred for these classic distances. So if there's anybody that I think is going to excel where some are going to be challenged, I think sometimes what we get in these Triple Crown races, and this was what I had said before the race actually about Drain the Clock as he was stretching out, I don't think he's going to excel at the two-turn distance, but I think there's a chance he could handle it. And that's what we see sometimes on this road to the Derby. Horses that are really not meant to do all of this, but can handle it. Whereas Greatest Honor is meant to go these longer distances. So to me, he's the one I've been the most impressed by. Essential Quality and Mandaloon are unbelievably talented as well. But I just think looking at the long-term scope, while many are going to have a question for distance, Greatest Honor is a horse that I have no questions about.
Hopefully we can finish this argument on the first Saturday in May. The last question, or last kind of sub-question, what do you think is the most overused angle you hear from handicappers, and what is one that you think is underused?
Well, that's interesting. For me, let's see, overused angle. I guess immediately you're always going to see money coming for a certain jockey, and that's something on the tip of my tongue because we see it happen all the time with Irad Ortiz in particular at Gulfstream and in New York as well, particularly I'd say down in Florida. Just betting a single jockey or a trainer as well, I think, is an overused angle, because even if that horse is the best horse in the race and the most likely winner, you're not going to get any value. You're also going to have horses that should not be that short a price, be overbet, and it could be positive because the horse that you like in that race could end up going off at a better price. I mean, you look at, as we stick with Fountain of Youth, back in the Holy Bull, Prime Factor was the favorite off of a 6-furlong maiden score because it was Todd Pletcher and Irad Ortiz, whereas Greatest Honor, who was coming in already having won going a mile and a 16th and finished ahead going a mile and an 8th, was not the favorite in the Holy Bull. To me, that's just insane. You know, it would be very clear of who the favorite should be. So I think that's a good example of something that's kind of overused and just betting particular trainer and jockey. I see it all the time. The horse that races off the turf, and whatever horse I ride or tease on is 4-5. And I sometimes get a little heated about it because I'm like, this race is not on the turf. Do not bet this horse. So you know, I think that that's something that just needs to you can pay attention. I mean, look, at Gulfstream, and especially in New York, in the summer and the fall, you've got the top riders in the country right there. Irad Ortiz is spectacular, but there's a lot of other good riders in the room as well. So that's something that I think we really see a lot of in Florida. An underused angle, let's see. One that I really like that I talk about a lot for Gulfstream in particular is the second race over the track. And I think that really suits in Florida because of the weather. So especially you'll see it from horses coming down from Maryland or New York. I'd say a little bit less so Kentucky, but especially if they come down from Woodbine. It's just such a drastic change. And horses in general handle weather and seasons better than we do as humans. They can handle the heat or the cold just fine. But I found going from Florida to New York to the cooler weather, they seem to really flourish. They like it when it's a little bit cooler. That's what they prefer. The ones that summer down in Florida are so used to the climate down here, whereas the ones that maybe are a little bit wintry or have been up north for a while, to me, I like to see at least a work or two, preferably a race, before I'm going to bet them after they've been in Florida.
One of Dave Litvin's famous angles from one of his books was betting them going from Florida up to New York in like March at the end of the Aqueduct meet. It was kind of like they're down there taking a vacation. They come up to New York and all of a sudden it's the, you know, 30, 45 degree weather that kind of just wakes them up in the morning and gets them to just all of a sudden wake up and run really well. And going back to your jockey angle as well, Diodoro and David Cohen on MTOs at Saratoga last year, I swear, I think that was all that Cohen won last year, was four or five races at like 6 or 5 to 1 as an MTO and an off the turf race. And I'm just like, am I the only one? Like, does someone have Laurel open for Naira? Like, how does no one not see if this horse is 5 for his last 6 in the money on the dirt and he's 6 to 1? Like, I don't know what I'm missing here. And then it almost makes you gun shy to put a bigger wager on. And then he wins and you're like, I could have doubled my wager there. And now I just, you know, I still won, but you kind of leaves a bad taste in your mouth.
For sure. For sure. You see it. You see some that are over bet or under bet because of certain names and I think recognition as well.
Let's jump right in then to our four races for today. The first race we're going to go over is race number 8. It is the Grade 3 Canadian Turf going 1/116 miles on the turf. What'd you like in here, Acacia?
So in this race, I thought that it was on paper looked like it was pretty wide open and an interesting spot to maybe find some value. I actually did land on Venezuelan Hug, and I realized that he was stepping up out of state-bred competition. But when you look at what he was running against prior to that, I mean, Gufo and No Word in the Grade 1 Belmont Derby. And speaking to connections, they said he really doesn't handle Belmont well. A track like Saratoga and Gulfstream with the tighter turns, he really seemed to flourish. And I had just seen him physically take such big steps forward. This was a great example. The number 5, Eons, ended up going off the favorite as Irad Ortiz was riding, even though he was beaten in his last couple of races. To me, probably the quote-unquote horse to beat was the 2, Olympic Runner, who was right behind Social Paranoia, 2 back, got the win last time out. The problem with him is that he is a very deep closer.
I think, too, for this race, I love that you said that it was wide open. I always have liked a horse that can be a distance specialist. Eons was 5 for 7 in the exact at this distance. He had a Grade 3 win in the Kent, Delaware. Obviously, we're at a completely different track and different class. I just didn't know exactly going forward for this race. Olympic Runner as well was in good form. In his last 7 races, he's lost by less than 2 lengths with a couple wins in there. I think he ran sneaky well in the graded state company. Mm-hmm. Venezuelan Hug, just 90 buyer, and just when I look at this type of horse, Alvarado's been lights out down there. Me and my father have been saying for years, Junior was one of the most underrated riders in New York, and I'm finally happy to see him go down there. I love the fact that you brought up the graded stake losses, because I didn't even really recognize that they were both at Belmont, and the fact that Connection said that he doesn't like Belmont then would put just such an extra credence that if you take both of those races out, he just won a couple of listed stakes at the state bred level, but with really good numbers compared to the rest of the field. So even though it's a lower class level, they kind of matched up really well here, jumping that little extra move up into the graded stakes company.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And like I said, I know it's against Florida breds in his last couple, but he's a Florida bred. Why not take advantage? It makes perfect sense at the end of the day.
And we talk about that a lot for the New York breds with having so much extra money in the maiden special weights there. And I feel like people, when they're handicapping a key handicapping principle nowadays is you really have to know, okay, where in the state bred level do they match up well again if they move over to open company? You might see a state bred allowance, you know, drop down to 50 open claimers and, you know, win by five, and everyone's like, but it's state bred to open. Yeah, but the, you know, state bred allowances sometimes can be a little bit saltier than those, you know, higher level claiming races.
They absolutely can. And I think one positive too to mention is that now at Gulfstream, at all Stronach Group tracks, at NYRA, the Breeders' Cup prep races, all graded stakes will be run without Lasix. Mm-hmm. So Venezuelan Hug had a win in the Sunshine Turf last time without Lasix. So he had already shown that that was not going to be something that was going to inhibit him.
And I think, too, I remember talking to a lot of handicappers when they had first announced that. Everyone was very upset because they're like, how am I supposed to know who's good on Lasix or off Lasix? And I said, you might have to wait a couple races. And once you know, you see the horses that win off Lasix, it's like, okay, they can handle it. The other ones cannot.
For sure.
Any other horse? Winter's back for Kendrick Carmouche from the outside. I just always know Kendrick is just always on the go, wants to get to that lead. And I was almost a little bit nervous that he could end up stealing it on the front end. The last two, the allowance and the maiden touch weight win, were with softer fractions. But when you see a horse like that, that, you know, needs to obviously from the outside get over as fast as possible, you want no one else but Kendrick in the saddle.
No, that's very true. I thought that he was going to be aggressively handled. I didn't think he would be lone speeding here because of the presence of Fancy Liquor, who also, when I saw him, just looked like a horse that was going to show speed. He was very sharp. He was on his toes. And then Busy Channel, seems like all of Larry Rivelli's horses, especially coming down to Florida, are super sharp out of the gate. So I didn't think that Winter's Back was going to be lone speed, but you're absolutely right as far as being able to clear from the outside. And also, you felt potentially in this race that Olympic Runner might be the one to beat. I mean, Winter's Back was just ahead behind him last time out and changing tactics. I think he's better when he's on the lead.
You bring up Fancy Liquor. There was also Dian Drive, the other Mike Maker in this race. And, you know, how many times have we seen Mike Maker claims two back, ends up running really well in the Woodchopper at Fairgrounds, now ships him over here. When you have two Makers in the race, it's almost as bad as when there's four Chads in the race sometimes.
Yeah, and I felt kind of bad because I didn't like either Maker in this race. And it wasn't that I was against either of them. It was just that I liked others better. To me, Dyna Drive's numbers were just too soft in stepping up to this level. I thought that he would certainly be a useful horse for the barn, but to me, he was just a cut below what he was facing in here.
When you see multiple horses for one specific trainer and you don't like either sometimes, does it almost make you not feel weird, but like then you talk to other people and they're like, oh yeah, I like the Maker. It's like, what am I missing? Am I just like, then you start to feel crazy. And when the horses don't run well, you're like, I just need to learn to trust my judgment.
Yeah, that's very true. That happens mostly for me in maiden races when there's either a Todd or a Chad or or two from the barn that I don't like. And especially with maiden races, I mean, I do a lot of research. So when I'm doing picks for maiden races, it is not just by a whim. I've watched all of the workouts if they're available on XBTV, if they went through a public auction. I've looked up the sales page. I've watched the breeze if it was a two-year-old sale. I've looked back through the pedigree in the last couple of generations. And I've also looked to see, you know, stats and the surface or if the pedigree matches up to what kind of condition they're running in. So if I don't like a horse that's from a top barn like that, you know that some are immediately just going to throw them in because of the name. And sometimes it's hard to get off of those because you're like, I'm supposed to use the Todd Pletcher Firster in here. And if you have an opinion against that horse, sometimes though, that's where you can find a good price.
For Acacia is Venezuelan Hug. For me, it was Eons. Let's see who can win the grade three right now.
Racing in the Canadian turf. From the rail, Busy Channel, centaured by Zayas, but Carmouche is on the go with Winter's Back. So the outside horse and the inside horse get acquainted as they run to the finish line the first time. Fancy Liquor is an early third from Gear Jockey, who's at the rail fourth. Then Olympic Ruthers together with Eons, two back to Venezuelan Hug. On hold second last is Monarch's Glen, and the early trailer is Dyna Drive. Field separated by 8 lengths in the run around the first turn. With rail position and the lead, Busy Channel leads by a length and a half. Winter's Back is second. Gear Jockey is at the rail third, followed fourth by Fancy Liquor. Olympic Runners in the pink and black colors between horses. Down at the rail goes Venezuelan Hug, then Eons. On hold and tugging is Monarch's Glen second last. And at the rail, it's Dyna Drive. He's last of all behind an opening quarter mile of 23-3. Less than 5/8 to go. Busy Channel has the lead. He leads narrowly. Up on the outside, that's Winter's Back, still second at the rail and Gear Jockey. Wide on the course goes Fancy Liquor. Olympic Runner is mid-flight. He's only 4 lengths off the lead with Venezuelan Hug moving up at his inside. Eons is unhurried while third last. Second last is Dyna Drive, and now the trailer is Monarch's Glen. Around the far turn they go, less than 3 furlongs to race. Busy Channel nursing a half-length lead. Winter's Back is second, Fancy Liquor on the outside third, Gear Jockey is there fourth, Olympic Runner is now fifth, followed by Venezuelan Hug, and they're at the top of the stretch. Winter's Back is up to challenge Busy Channel for the lead. Gear Jockey off cover for an upset threat, Olympic Runner down the stand side. Eighth of a mile to go in the Canadian turf, and here comes Olympic Runner, charging hard down the center. Olympic Runner for the lead, Venezuelan Hug leads. Venezuelan Hug and Olympic Runner come to the wire together. It might have been inside as Venezuelan Hug shook free under Junior Alvarado.
And the number 6, Venezuelan Hug, gets it done at a great price of $11 with a 96 buyer. Great pick, Acacia.
Thank you very much. That was exciting. And what a ride by Junior Alvarado. Yeah. I think the hats go off to him for getting up in between horses late. The horse was very game and Junior gave him an excellent ride.
I think this is a good talking point as well. Sometimes, you know, we see a horse do something like that, and other times they'll shy away from the hole because maybe the hole isn't as big as people think it is. And a lot of times that's where you'll get the jockey bashing. Oh, how do you not get that horse through the hole? It's a 1,000-pound animal, and a 100-pound man. He's not going to get the horse to go through the hole if the horse doesn't want to go through it.
Yeah, that's true. And some of them are not as willing to go through in between horses. It can be a very compromising position for many animals, and some of them that just don't want to. So you have to pick and choose your spots very carefully.
I think, too, with turf racing, people, you know, struggle with it a lot more than dirt racing, and this is a good race to prove it. Not many horses improved a lot, but that's usually how it happens. It's not the big 15, you know, 10-point jump-ups in the buyers. It's 2 or 3 points every time. Venezuelan Hug goes from a 92 to a 96. Olympic Runner only improves that 1 point. But what surprised me the most about the race was Olympic Runner's price. I mean, everyone thought, you know, this horse was probably going to be, you know, 5-2, somewhere in that range. He goes up at 4-1. If I was redoing my picks and it wasn't a pick and pray, I would have been all over Olympic Runner.
No, I agree. I was very surprised, like I said before, that Eons was the favorite. And I had had him in my top 4 picks. I thought he was a logical player. But I think it's another great example of a horse that had ability but likely should have been a little bit more of a price in that spot.
When you see the quote-unquote public mistake that makes the wrong favorite, one that you think might just be a false favorite, not even just vulnerable, and we try and attack those races as much as we can, I feel like too many people will then, you know, try and go 3 or 4 deep in exotics, and they'll just sometimes even just forget the regular win bet. And the top 2 runners being, you know, so close together, they were both paying $10.
No, you're absolutely right. And I thought it was, I think to me, it was a great example of a wide open turf race and why I really enjoy betting and handicapping turf races like this, because you've got a lot of quality. You've got some that are going to immediately fly under the radar. Like we said, certain horses are just always going to tend to be bet. And this is a great way to find some value in the middle of the card.
The last point for me from this race, the third place horse, Gear Jockey. I was kind of against Rusty Arnold's maiden winner. Yeah. I feel going forward now, I kind of have to relook at the maiden winner stepping up to the graded state class, 26-1, solid third, just missing.
Yeah, and you know, I guess he's a good talking point in that it took him forever to break his maiden, mm-hmm. but he finally did. And even though he didn't win some of those maiden races, he always ran well. I mean, he's already a third in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf and a third in the Bourbon. So he's now multiple graded stakes place at 2 and at 4. So he has a big ability to grab a share. So he's one at a big price you should look at using underneath.
Let's move on to the next race. Race number 9, it was the Windstar Gulfstream Park Mile. 1 mile on the dirt. What'd you like in here, Acacia?
Well, my top pick was Performer when I was handicapping. He was one that I had had some big reservations about last time out, and yet he got the win, and he was a horse that always I wanted to be good. He's a big, solid horse. I don't think that he liked the wet track at all in the Cigar Mile. The last time, Eye of a Jedi gave him pretty much everything he could handle. He ran a really solid race. The tough thing about Performer is that the way I describe him is he's always a little bit of a hot mess. You know, he gets really kind of wound up, and he gets really sweaty before his races, and he's like that training too. And I imagine he's a very difficult horse to train as well. So he was the top pick on paper. And in second, I had the 5 Fearless, who had run some good races, but was coming off of a layoff. But there's nobody better, I think, than you look at Todd Pletcher's numbers coming back off a layoff, going a distance of ground, and it's so impressive. And just based off of physicality on the track, this horse completely won me over. He blew Performer out of the water. So I was locked into Performer for the picks beforehand, but I fell in love with Fearless on the track when I saw him on the off the layoff.
This, for me, was almost a race where I almost didn't want to handicap, let alone I saw Performer back in the race. I had bet Eye of a Jedi very hard last time out, and I said, they're both back. I'm just going to play Eye of a Jedi again. All the money is going to go in on Performer. It'll be another race where he's been, now it was the last 4 races under even money, and ended up winning 4 and last time out, but that doesn't equal out positive ROI. And in these types of races, if you like Performer, you almost have to just put him in a double, try to hit the exacta to make him worth something. And people who just bet these win tickets at playing for the bet squad, they're like, well, you know, I like Jackie's Warrior last year. And I'm like, well, it's going to be even money. It's kind of hard to make money that way. And it's been hard teaching people because you don't know if this person is here for the day and just wants to have just like they're out at the movies and have fun that way. Or, oh, I see Joe here 6 days a week. Let me try and teach him some stuff with the bankroll management.
No, absolutely. And I think that this is a good case that you either try to use him, like you said, with a price horse, or if you really have such a strong opinion about him, is to use him almost as your free bingo square if you're making multi-race wagers, if you have such a strong opinion. If it's a horse that's a short price and you're not sold on, I honestly think the best way to try to make money is to toss him in those multi-race wagers. The tickets that I put out on air every day, it's tough to really do that because you're trying to make it a guide and you're trying to hit those tickets for people that maybe are not as familiar with ticket construction and things like that. But if I'm playing a pick 4, I would likely toss Performer and use something like Fearless and Eye of the Jedi.
I think, too, just going back to when I was a beginning handicapper and watching TVG late at night, and these guys are having to put pick 5 and pick 4 tickets out for Delta Downs in Charlestown. It's like, now knowing what I know, they probably barely even could watch the circuit because they were so busy with doing other things in their lives, and they're telling them to put these big sequences together. And then you have the plus EV police on Twitter. Oh, you shouldn't be playing, you know, a favorite with 3 other horses. And I get it. That's the rule. It's the same thing with exacta boxes. Don't play exacta boxes. Weigh out your opinions. But at some point, to me, if I'm positive over 100 exacta boxes and I'm just going to lose, you know, 4 or 5%, you know, vig off the top, but it keeps my mental sanity, then that's what I'm going to do. Because this game is just, it's not the 14 race card today. It's get ready for 6 weeks at Saratoga in a couple months.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It has a way of beating you down. And the thing with this race, too, is that the only other horse that was probably going to take a lot of money in this spot was Tax, and he scratched. So that meant that Performer was going to be an even shorter price. So you have to find ways to get creative.
For Acacia, it was Performer and a little bit of Fearless. For me, it was Eye of the Jedi looking to get revenge from the last race. Let's see who can win the Gulfstream Park Mile right now.
And they're off in the Windstar Gulfstream Park Mile. From the far outside, Wind of Change was away quickly, and he's in front a length and a half as Performer will move to his outside and race on from second. Fearless is in early third. Down at the inside goes Fat Man with Eye of a Jedi, and Avant Garde's out in the center. Wind of Change is loose, and he's running off. He's open to six-length lead now. Performer taken in hand by Jose Ortiz and races from second. Fearless on his outside. The Fat Man moves through at the rail. Followed in the pink by Eye of a Jedi. He's fifth of the six. The trailer is Avant Garde, and the leader is Wind of Change. 5/8 left to go through the opening quarter of 23-3. Wind of Change trying to back it down mid-race. He leads by four. Performer is second. Fat Man is third. Fearless three wide while fourth. Eye of a Jedi is together with Avant Garde at the back, less than half a mile from the finish. 46-2 for the opening half mile. Wind of Change leads, but he's only three on top. Here comes Fearless. He moves up and by Performer, who will have to do much better than that. Fat Man is at the rail, then Avant Garde. Nothing today from Eye of a Jedi, and we have a new leader. Fearless, let go by Irad Ortiz Jr., and he's willing and on to take over. Performer tries to muster another effort. Avant Garde underway from the back. Fat Man is next after three quarters in 1:10-2. They turn for home in the Windstar Gulfstream Park mile with Windstar to catch as Fearless is an eighth of a mile from home and a length on top. Avant Garde takes aim second. Performer has been defeated. 16th to go. Fearless driven out. Avant Garde can't get by as Fearless wins the Gulfstream Park mile.
And the number five, Fearless, gets it done, paying $760 with a 102 buyer. I think the story of this race as well was the second place horse Avant Garde also running second. Both of these horses are horse for courses. As far as I can see, 5/7 for Avant Garde, 3/3 for Fearless. It pays to see who's winning at Gulfstream Park every single start.
No, it's very true. And I looked back at my notes from his Fearless's first couple of races at Gulfstream back in the end of 2019 and beginning of 2020. And it was something I had talked about with Todd Fletcher before the race. And he had shown some speed. He'd been kind of an on his toes type of individual, that he would be touting himself, that he would be more up in the game a little bit more. And that's what he was off this layoff here. He wasn't coming from so far back, 15 lengths back, like he was at Oaklawn, you know, towards the start of this past year. So it was nice to see him kind of revert back to that running style as well, which suits here at Gulfstream and clearly suits Fearless.
I think this is a good study also for people who are trying to become, you know, replay watchers and stuff. The seven tries to go out and steal it on a big early lead.
Yeah.
But when Fearless goes by Performer looks like he's tied to a post.
Mm-hmm. I had heard that Shig McGay, he said afterwards that he wasn't handling the track. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I think while last time was okay, this is a big step in the right direction for Performer. As much as I like him and I want him to be good, I think, unfortunately, this Gulfstream mile was kind of a sign that he's a very nice horse. He's a bit overrated.
I couldn't agree with you more. This always feels like if Performer can get the right type of field and the grade at stake, he will win. If he gets any up-and-coming allowance horse that, you know, will, you know, 2 or 3 years down the road maybe be a grade one winner, he will lose that horse every single time. Performer still ended up beating Eye of a Jedi. Eye of a Jedi's price also at 6-1 for me was a little bit awkward. I will say this, though. When you look at a horse like Eye of a Jedi and you see the low winning connections, Manise and Steve Budhu, just the last two times out, hitting the board at 13-1 and 10-1, I call these the overachievers. And just, I don't think enough people, when they're looking at the PPs, look at what the horses went off at last time. 6-1, now I'm getting my price cut in half again, was probably a little bit too short. But if he had gone off at 10-1 again, I'm still fine betting this horse back, even knowing that he might run this type of race.
6-1 is way too short on Eye of a Jedi, and I'm a fan. He definitely is an overachiever. Steve Badu, I think, has only maybe a handful of horses, 5 or 6, if more, not many more. And Marcos Meneses just doesn't get a lot of opportunities during the championship meet with the Ortiz brothers and Paco and all of the top riders that are there. So you're certainly rooting for them. But this is a horse that has run some good races, but he is a long shot play for sure.
Let's move on to our third race, race number 10. It's an optional claiming 62 going 1/1/16 miles on the turf. There's like five conditions in this race. Horses are coming from all over. What would you like in here, Acacia?
Well, I, looking back, was totally wrong about this race. I will say that I was correct about one thing, and that I didn't see a lot of speed signed on. I felt that we were going to see Sayaf try to set the pace, but wasn't going to be able to hold on to it. And I felt that this was a good handicapping lesson, because for some reason, Sayaf is a horse that I have just never warmed to. I've always been distrustful of him. How can I beat him? How can I not take this horse that's usually a short price and I just don't trust him? So I was totally against him. I felt he was a sprinter stretching out, and maybe Opry was going to be forwardly placed. Bodie Cream could potentially be the main kind of true speed in here. And I had a bit of a price play that I liked in the 9 Street Ready, who was off a layoff for Ian Wilkes and had ran second by a nose to Field Pass in the Grade 3 Transylvania in his last start. A lower profile jockey in Miguel Vasquez. And I felt that he was one who maybe could sit a good trip in here.
Now we get back to your most overused angle. I read Ortiz and Todd Pletcher, Opry for me in this race. I just, to me, just kind of felt when you looked back, just did so well as a younger horse in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf, and with anticipation, you know, winning in one, and then, you know, didn't run so well in the yielding turf at Churchill, had now kind of come back and then put a second to win, a couple, and a third. And that fourth by a length and a half, to me, is almost as good as hitting the board. Everyone will see the four and just think horse didn't hit the board. And nobody ever looks at the beaten lengths. So I thought he could definitely be dangerous. But then again, Sayaf is the other Todd Pletcher in this race. And now you're kind of playing devil's advocate. Which one, you know, which one does Todd like better? If Javier's on this one, then obviously Irad must have liked the other one. And it just becomes a whole big confusing puddle of mud in your handicapping.
Yeah, absolutely. And both of them were running against excellent horses, except that Sayaf comes out of a 5 furlong turf sprint stake behind Imprimis and Extravagant Kid. And then you've got Opry, who ran behind Olympic Runner and Winter's Back, who we were just going to be seeing earlier in Grade 3 company. So you're like, okay, if I'm looking at the distance, then of the two Pletcher runners, Opry has Irad Ortiz, has the distance, has the back class. It just makes sense. But again, talking about my own rule of looking at pace and trying to analyze how the race is going to play out, you try to visualize what it's going to be. And one thing I will say is on this turf course at Gulfstream, it's evened out a little bit now, but over the last couple of weeks, the turf has been carrying speed, and we've seen horses that get comfortable on the front end just keep going.
For Acacia, it was Street Ready. For me, it was Irad, Ortiz, Todd Pletcher, and Opry. Let's see who can get the win here in the 10th right now.
And they're off. Poor beginnings for Caninos and Alma Shriek. Quick start for Sayaf, and on the stretch out, he'll establish the early pace from Blameless, who moves up to take second. Down at the rail, that's Malibu Mambo, who's in early third. Outside and Street Ready, he's into the top flight, racing a length better than Bodie Cream, who's mid-flight. Wide on the course and improving a touch now is Angelus Warrior. Just ahead of him went the favorite Opry, then back to Clear Vision and Alma Streak, and the early trailer is Caninos. They move around the first turn. Sayaf and jockey Javier Castellano boot clear to lead by 5 from Blameless in second and Street Ready third. Malibu Mambo is next toward the rail, followed by Bodie Cream. Length and a half to first Premio and the Team Valor Forest Green Colors racing about 8 lengths off the lead. Opry is next ahead of Angelus Warrior, then Clear Vision. Still at the back are Alma Shriek and Canenos is at the back. 23-2 for the opening quarter. Sayaf still rolling along through a 46 3/2 mile. He's isolated himself on the front end. He leads by 6 or 7 lengths. Second is Blameless. Third is Street Ready. Malibu Mambo fourth. Bodie Cream is fifth. Winding up from the back is Canenos, moving up with him and Angelus Warrior. Dropping back a touch, first Premio. Opry needs to do a lot of work and time ticking away. Then Clear Vision and Alma Streak as they run to the top of the stretch. Sayaf in a bid to go the distance here. He's a quarter of a mile from home and 4 on top. Starting to close some ground is Bodie Cream while getting to the clear. On his back, Angelus Warrior. Malibu Mambo cuts the corner and comes on next, but Sayaf is still well clear, and now he's less than an eighth of a mile from home. Sayaf by 5. Blameless is trying to hold on to second, then Malibu Mambo, Bodie Cream, Angelus Warrior, and First Premio as they come home for the wire. Sayoff slowing down, but Sayoff is saved by the wire.
And the number four, Sayoff gets it done, paying $13.40 with a 94 buyer. As soon as I watched this race, I said, you idiot, all you had to do was bet the other Pletcher.
I know. And Xavier Castellano, I mean, you think about it, and it's so easy in retrospect. But again, it's a horse that's stretching out for sprint distance. When you look back, though, in December of 2019, Sayoff wired the field going a mile at Gulfstream. The speed carries on the turf course, and it's particularly the case here. So I was right that there wasn't a lot of speed. I was completely wrong that this horse wasn't going to be able to sustain it.
I think, too, just when you bring up that excellent point, already we've seen from below 6 furlongs the horse has stretched out and won. I think that first race after coming out of the Brown Barn, just Todd didn't really know what to do. Maybe the horse didn't like Aqueduct. That could be the thing. Chips him down, runs really, really well in the 75K stake, and now they just stretch him out again. And maybe that is the whole reason and the whole factoid to it. The horse has 3 wins or 4 wins now in his life. One of them has come doing that. The other one was also stretching out a little bit from 5.5 to 6, if you can even call that a stretch out. Maybe this horse just needs, you know, to get that little stretch out now and again, and won't be a, you know, barn burner, won't, you know, win 4 out of 5 races, but, you know, every couple, five, six races, the horse just puts up a banger of a race.
No, absolutely. And once again, that early speed is very, very, mm-hmm. a very, very dangerous weapon to have, and he certainly has that in spades.
I think, too, looking forward from this race as well, the workouts, 48 and 3, 47. The horse was just absolutely working out phenomenally over at Palm Beach Downs.
Those are very fast workouts for Palm Beach Downs, too. Typically at the training centers, you don't see things that are that quick. I mean, you even look at a horse like Opry over the same surface, it's going 49 and 1 or 50. And that's honestly typical for the surface there at Palm Beach Downs.
I think that brings another, you know, if you're following one circuit, you know, people say it all the time, oh, I'm playing 5 tracks at the OTB. But if you're following one circuit and you can find little tiny nuggets like this, the training track for a specific track and what they're usually doing, and seeing a horse coming in and doing numbers way better, you know, we talk about it all the time, you know, horses shipping around, you know, from, you know, what was Calder or Oaklawn, that tiring surface, and they come into a track like this, and then they all of a sudden just blitz a field and they're running terrible at the other track. Well, a lot of it was just that they were, you know, getting that stamina built up over at the other track.
No, it's very true. I mean, you look at horses, you can even see it in New York. I think what we really see as well is, you know, horses training over the Oklahoma training track that ship down to Belmont to race and are very successful. And just, you know, those strong tracks to leg up a horse and get them ready for the race.
Let's move on to the last race of this podcast, race number 12. It was the Grade 2 Devona Dale. It was what I thought was my best handicapping horse of last year, and VQuist coming back to the races. What did you like in here, Acacia?
Well, I picked VQuist. I was looking forward to seeing her come back. I had in second Mille Foy, the 5 for Belmont, who ran second in the Demoiselle. I knew distance wasn't going to be a problem for her. And I did not like either of them when I saw them physically before the race, so I was left with a little bit of a trouble. Again, locked in with the picks, it was the 3 VQuist for me. Unfortunately, when I saw her, I was disappointed because I remembered her in New York and at the Breeders' Cup as this big filly, but she always carried a lot of substance, and she looked very light to me. She didn't seem to be carrying as much flesh as I would like, and I did not like the warm-up that she had at all. She was throwing her head up. She was fighting against Irad Ortiz. She never looked settled. So I was really concerned after seeing that. And then the 5 Mille Foy just looked a bit flat, to be honest. So I didn't really know what to do after that. There were some other horses that I thought looked good. The 6 Crazy Beautiful, I liked her overall appearance. Again, was locked in with the pick with VQuist, but was nervous when I saw her in the flesh.
Obviously, for someone like me who grew up with Naira, grew up with Maggie, there used to be an old rule with the OTB. If Maggie was speaking, everyone shut up. That was how we ran that OTB. When you say she wasn't carrying her flesh that well and she looked so much better in New York, was it just kind of maybe she spent too much time on the farm and really wasn't eating that well going into the race, or was it something else that you were kind of seeing?
No, sometimes horses, when they ship or they travel, and she was just shipping down from Palmettos, but actually after the race, I spoke to Jenny, who's Butch Reed's wife, and said, you know, she got so big as a three-year-old when she was on the van shipping down from Palmetto's. She took up the whole stall in the van to ship down, and she was so uncomfortable there. And I thought that that was really interesting because she did. It was almost like a teenager that has a growth spurt and all of a sudden is so lanky. That's kind of what it looked like to me. Sometimes horses that are not being good doers, that are under some sort of stress for some reason, and they can stress themselves out regardless of what the trainer does. They're just hard to keep weight on, and you don't know the story behind the scenes. You don't know things that are going on. But she looked different from what I saw from her when she won, and it wasn't in a positive way. So that to me was immediately a red flag. I keep notes on my iPad of every horse that I see. I know Maggie does the same. I know a lot of other people that look at horses and follow them physically do that. And that's where those notes really come into play. And a change from one race to another, a positive or a negative, can be the best handicapping tool.
I can't agree with you more there. I was also on VQuist just from the fact that I thought it would kind of be like the, you know, 9 out of 10 of them, when they come back out of those big Breeders' Cup races, they'll just win pretty easily. It's like they're prepped for the things down the road, and there's always that one. I think it was Jaywalk a couple of years ago, maybe in the same race, who, you know, came out of that, you know, great Breeders' Cup performance and then just was flat as could be.
Yep, and it's funny. This Devona Dale, Gabby Gaudette and I were talking about it after the end of the day, and you look back at the horses that have won this race, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are not very memorable. I believe that the biggest or second biggest prize was beating Jaywalk a couple of years ago in Jeltrin, who mm-hmm. did it at 50-something to 1 in the Devona Dale. We saw Catherine Sophia win the race a few years back, but that's really kind of the only big name. Tonalist Shape last year was not able to move on from this race. She was a formful winner of the race, but prior to that, we've seen some kind of funky things happen where horses don't carry on that form from 2 to 3.
It's almost like the male or the female version of the Remsen, where everyone says it's one of the mm-hmm. worst Derby preps. Interesting that we can now see that. It will be interesting to see down the road, even next year and the years coming, you know, what comes out of this race. Mm-hmm. It's a consensus pick for me in Acacia and VQuist. Let's see if she can get it done here in her comeback race in the Devona Dale right now.
And they're off in the Devona Dale. A smooth beginning for the race favorite VQuist, and she'll reach out for some forward position. Moving out the rail, Hole Bodemeister is on the offense early. Far outside goes 3 Tipsy Chicks with Penn Street not far away. Now splitting horses, here's Adios Trippy. So Adios Trippy will go after Hole Bodemeister. They're the top duo, with VQuist now third. Curlin's Catch at the inside is fourth, followed by Penn Street, then Milfoy from the outside of her and Crazy Beautiful. It's a length and a half to competitive speed, who's dropped better than 7 lengths off the lead. 3 Tipsy Chicks is on her outside, and the trailer is Happy Constitution. They complete the opening quarter and head to the half-mile point. Hole Bodemeister on the inside, Adios Trippy keeping her on us from the outside. These top two have 3 on Curlin's Catch, who's now third. Milfoy is now moved up between horses to take 4th. 3 wide while 5th, that's VQuist. Out 4 wide on the course. Here's a move from Penn Street. That'll force Irad to send VQuist on with the task, as she'll need to keep her spot. She's responding nicely at the 3-furlong point, and Hole Bodemeister is still in front. From the outside, here's that move from Penn Street in competitive speed toward the rail and Curlin's Catch. Trying to wind it up from the back is Crazy Beautiful. Happy Constitution's out of last, and 3 Tipsy Chicks is the trailer, and VQuist will have to do a lot better than that. She's losing ground to Hole Bodemeister, who's 50-1 and finding plenty. There's an 1/8 of a mile to go, and Hole Bodemeister is kicked clear with authority. Up on the outside, Crazy Beautiful tries to get competitive speed for 2nd. Penn Street running on for 4th, but a huge run at a huge price. Edgard Zayas and Hole Bodemeister shocked the Devona Dale. They won by 5.
And the number 1, Hole Bodemeister, gets it done, paying a whopping $107, 84 buyer. I think this goes just to prove exactly in this race, 84 for a grade 2 for horses that are supposed to be on their way to the Kentucky Oaks trail. This is mm-hmm. not looking good.
This is not a race that I'm going to put a lot into moving forward. Now, that said, when you go through and you look at Hole Bodemeister's races, you're like, okay, she's really not that crazy of a winner. I think if, you know, the eight horse Adios Trippy, who was setting the pace with her, had ended up staying on, you would have been really surprised. But Whole Bodemeister finished third last time in the Forward Gal. And I still, though the favorite won the Forward Gal, I don't think it was the strongest race. I actually was very disappointed by the performance from Zygel that day. But I had interviewed Edgar Zayas before the Forward Gal, and he said in the race at Tampa, where this filly had ducked the break, she was completely out of her comfort style with her running style and the way that she ran. He thought it was a throwout, and he also thought that she didn't like the Tampa track at all. And so I hadn't really picked her. I'd kind of just needed an interview, and I was talking to Edgar about another horse on the card. Mm-hmm. I think it was Drain the Clock for the Swale. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to play a bet across. She's 17-1. And she finished third at a big price. And silly me did not remember that on the day of the Devona Jail and thinking, hey, she's a live long shot that I may want to use underneath. And Edgar Zayas, after the race, said to me, you could see her kind of ducking in, ducking out in the stretch. She's still very green. She's still figuring things out. But she's clearly a filly that has ability. She has natural speed. Will she be up to the Kentucky Oaks level? As of now, and given the numbers that she's run, I don't think so. But she's a very useful horse. And like I said, she's really not that much of a surprise as far as a long shot that you thought could be live in here.
I forget the handicapper who I had this conversation with back in the day, but we always talked about when races kind of fell apart and, you know, the top three choices all ran terrible. And in this race, three of the top four are 50-1 shots or more. Mm-hmm. And for me in this race, it's a complete toss out. I understand that, you know, a horse has to win this race. It's almost like the maiden races, yeah, where you see six of the eight are 0-10+, and someone just has to win and do it. And they usually win with like a 44 buyer, and just one of the races on the cards that it's almost impossible to handicap. I think going forward, I think that the story with VQuist, you know, not really liking the ship, that'll be a note I instantly will put down to my formulator. And I think next time out, you know, she'll probably come back out, hopefully like she was. The other horse he would like, Milfoil, I just thought the grade 2 Demoiselle was on the slop, big improvement, and being out of Curlin, I kind of made that as a mark against. Obviously, being lightly raced, they can always improve leaps and bounds, but Curlin, Munnings, the Spite Sound when they run in the wet track, I always don't try to give as big a credence as other people do because I know how well those horses do on a wet track.
No, you're very right, and that's a really good point. The thing I had liked most about her, honestly, was the fact that everything that Bill Mott's been sending out has been winning. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this was a spot where that didn't hold true to form, but you're absolutely right about her record overall, and that's something to keep in mind for Milfoil moving forward. I think maybe the only one that really ran true to form was the Six Crazy Beautifuls. I don't think that she's a one-turn horse. I think she's a two-turn horse, and she probably will benefit from this race moving forward when they head back to Kentucky.
I think Crazy Beautiful is kind of a filly of three stories, and the Alcibiades had a perfect setup on a slow pace to run second against Simply Ravishing. Then just, I think, was just up against it in the Breeders' Cup. Just, I think there were just a couple that were just better than her in general, and now finds a second place here in a field where, you know, the horses that took money just didn't really run well, and she still ends up running second against a horse that at the top of the stretch was 5 or 6 clear.
No, it's very true. I mean, the prices in the top five were just unreal, and this is a race I think you could have just thrown a dart at the board and you might have had better luck picking the winner than if you actually handicapped it through each way like we all did. VQuist next time out, I think I'm going to weigh things a lot more carefully, but I'm not willing to completely give up on her just yet.
I can't agree with you more there. That's the end of the podcast. Thank you so much, Acacia, for coming on. Where can people find you on social media?
I'm Acacia_Courtney on Twitter and Instagram, and feel free to give a follow, and hopefully we can find some good information together.
When are we dropping that next podcast for the In the Ring?
That will be out Tuesday of this week.
Thank you so much again for coming on.
Thank you.
A very special thanks again to all my listeners and also to my special guest, Acacia Courtney. Special note for next week, doing two pods, I'm going to have Michelle Yu on to cover all the wonderful stakes action from Santa Anita, and the one and only Andy Serling to talk Gotham Stakes and other races from that Saturday card aqueduct. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's president is Pierre Thomas Florentale. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin, and our In the Money Media business manager is Drew Cotney. I'm Spencer Lugenbuehl, and we will see you next time. Nowhere to hide from all of this.